the diaries of Sofia Tolstoy, right? And this was I think an interesting little piece. You can find it again on this website. It comes from the Guardian, the English newspaper, and this is Sofia Tolstoy was the long-suffering and really quite intellectual and literary wife of Leo, and she began keeping diaries at 16, but began doing so avidly after she married Tolstoy. She never stopped writing in her journal until her death in 1919, as the Bolshevik Revolution threatened to overwhelm Yasnaya Polyana, the 4,000-acre estate where she had lived for more than half a century. There was a meeting to decide how best to defend Yasnaya Polyana against looting, she writes in her final entry. Nothing has yet been decided. Carts, oxen, and people are streaming down the highway to Tula. History, as it were, threatened to destroy everything she loved, it says of her. The problem was that Tolstoy shifted gears dramatically in midlife. Becoming a religious guru, turning his back on fiction, he evolved into a kind of saint, attracting disciples from around the world, including Gandhi. He shaped his own version of Christianity, discounting its miraculous aspects. Worse, from Sophia's viewpoint, he threatened to give away all his property, including the copyright to his work, to the Russian people. A psychodrama emerged with Sophia battling Tolstoy's disciples for access to his soul. Her diaries become increasingly frenzied in the 1880s and 90s, and the last decade of Tolstoy's life, 1900 to 1910, makes for harrowing reading, as in this entry for November 1903. I went to my husband's room this evening as he was getting ready for bed, and I realized I never hear a single word of comfort or kindness from him nowadays. What I predicted indeed has come true. My passionate husband has died, and since he was never a friend to me, how could he be one to me now? This life is not for me. There is nowhere for me to put my energy and my passion for life. No contact with people, no art, no work, nothing but total loneliness all day. She sees herself as surrounded by the raving of lunatics. All the talk around her was of celibacy, vegetarianism, and political resistance. Her husband had become his followers, and they crowded around, camping outside the manor house, pestering for interviews, taking photographs, telling the whole world that Sophia and Leo were at odds. So on it goes. But by the end, she was actually excluded from his death, as you may know the story of him getting up in the middle of the night and leaving Yasnaya Polyana and going on until he finally comes to ground at a station, railroad station, where his disciples found where he was, but they kept out his wife. By Tolstoy's followers. It was a real case of one of the first modern phenomena of the fans get their way no matter what.
Was it Tolstoy's wish that his wife be kept out?
Well, this was a situation that had built up over some time, over the years, he'd had all these followers, and he had, as it says, he had become his followers. So he took on that whole personality that they seemed to want in their guru. So this was this review was written by Jay Perini, who is a well-known literary biographer. He wrote a biography of Faulkner. It's not a terribly great biography of Faulkner. But he also has written a historical novel based on the last days of Tolstoy called The Last Station. And I learned also by internet, click, 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 that there's a movie coming out called The Last Station, and apparently Sofia Tolstoy will get her due because she's going to be played by Helen Mirren. So that's my bit of news, for cultural news for the day.
By the way, some of the events described in Sofia's diary are included in that chronology that I put on Blackboard. as a matter of fact, under AS. Well, let's see. It occurred to me that maybe I should follow up what we did with Victor Considérant and point to a little bit of surviving history in relation this time to Anna Karenina. The turning point in Anna's understanding of her situation comes when she goes to the opera. You remember that scene? It's on page, let's see. It starts on page 424. No, I'm sorry. No, it doesn't. Later than that. 494. 492. Mm-hmm. At the bottom, I expect you're going to hear Patti, asked Tuskovich. Patti, that's an idea. I'd go if I could get a box. I could get you one, said Tuskovich. I should be very, very grateful if you would, replied Anna. But won't you stay and dine with us? And then we get Vronsky's thoughts. Was it conceivable that in her position, she was going to the opera when Patti was to sing and when all the subscribers, her society acquaintances, that is, Tushkevich's society acquaintances, would be present? He looked seriously at her, but she answered him with the same provocative glance of high spirits or desperation, the meaning which he could not make out. And then on the next page, we discover that she's going alone. And then on 495, Vronsky would have liked to have said something to her, but he doesn't. Had he told her frankly what he thought, this is the top of the page, beginning of the chapter, he could have said, to appear dressed as you are at the theater, accompanied by the princess, whom everybody knows, means not only to acknowledge your position as a fallen woman, but to throw down a challenge to society, which means to renounce it forever. So Vronsky knows very clearly what will happen if she makes this appearance. This will be the end of her ability to appear in public. And she goes anyway. And how could she fail to understand it, he says. And what is happening to her? He felt that his regard for her had diminished and his consciousness of her beauty increased simultaneously. So this is a turning point in their relationship. Now, it's interesting that, by the way, Patti was by the... I'll tell you something about Adelina Patti. Okay, her parents were Italian, but she was born in Spain. They moved to New York City when she was a child, and she grew up in New York. She was born in 1843. She made her professional debut when she was 16. She went to Europe. She sang in New York and then went to Europe. And there she met Gioachino Rossini, the composer of his most famous operas, The Barber of Seville. This was during the last 2 years of Rossini's life. So this was when she was about 19. And then she had been a professional singer for 3 years. And so she sang an aria from The Barber of Seville for Rossini. But her impresario, her manager, who was himself a composer, had put all kinds of flourishes in it to show off her voice. And Rossini was impressed with her voice, but he said, "What is that song you sang?" And the impresario, whose name was Strakowski, said "But maestro, it's your song." And Rossini said, using a very clever French pun, because they were in Paris at this time, he said, "That's a lot of strashconnerie," which in French means roughly garbage. It was a pun on Strakowski's name, and connerie in French, which is slightly Well, in the 19th century, it was slightly impolite. So a bunch of nonsense, a bunch of foolishness. But anyway, so Patti met Rossini. Now, remember, Rossini was roughly a contemporary of Beethoven. So her voice goes all the way back to the, and her style goes all the way back to the late 19th century. By the time she's singing in Petersburg, and we discover Anna, and later Vronsky comes in, she is, this would be sometime in the 1870s. So she's in her, she's about 30 by now, and is really very famous indeed. And you can gather from the context here that she is famous enough that everybody in St. Petersburg is going to turn out to hear her. This is a special event. Verdi, Giuseppe Verdi, the other great 19th century Italian opera composer, said that Patti had the greatest voice of any singer he knew. All right, so.
Are we supposed to think that everybody in St. Petersburg either knew Italian or would have a Russian translation in their hands?
Oh, at operas in the 19th century, they all had the text when they went to the operas for sale. Sometimes. In Italy, you got the text in Italian to follow along.
So it's not, because I was thinking I just get to go and listen to music and not know what's going on.
Oh, yeah, no, they knew all. They'd read through all of this, they knew the story, then. Probably they knew a lot of the music, sure. Just like opera buffs do today. No great difference. Except that the opera was popular then, and now it's a very remote sort of experience, high culture sort of thing. Well, all right, Patti had married in 1868 when she was 25. And it was not a happy marriage. They divorced in 1878, so just after Anna Karenina was published. But meantime, both she and her husband were notorious for the affairs they'd been having in the meantime. So you have this interesting play going on with Patti singing on the stage, and who's obviously been having extramarital affairs, as has her husband. Her husband started first, and then she, in revenge, followed through. So they would all know this, even though it's not mentioned in the novel. And then here's Anna, who shows up among the society ladies, and she is also having an affair. So it's all right to have an affair. Well, it's not all right, but nobody will do anything about it, but you have to keep it secret. Unless you're a famous singer, you know, or a Hollywood movie star or something of the sort. Well, when Patti's career, she gave a number of farewell concerts toward Europe and the United States, but she stopped singing publicly in 1903. So by now she was 60. In 1905-06, she got interested in the gramophone and made recordings. And so it is startling to realize that we have a 103-year-old recording of Adelaide Patti singing at the age of 63. Now, no soprano, however great she may have been in the lifetime of Giuseppe Verdi, nobody at the age of 63 is going to have the voice she had at 30, and she was probably at her peak vocally. So you have to bear that in mind. But I thought you'd get a kick out of hearing this. This is an aria or a song, really, from Mozart's Marriage of Figaro. And it is Voi che sapete, you who know all about love, sung by Cherubino, who is a teenage boy who's fallen in love with the Countess, but the role is always sung by a woman. Men's voices, by the way, changed a lot later in the 19th century than in the 20th. This is what's called a trousers role in opera. You know, a boy played by a girl. And in Shakespeare's time, you know, they had girls played by boys, so it was, you might say, feminine revenge. Okay, here we go. Stop there, but it's remarkable if you think, you see, this is the only way we have a sense of how people sang 160 years ago, because she would have been taught by her teachers, who would have retained the style of singing around the 1840s, 50s. And you will not hear opera sung in this style today, because it was a much more intimate theater that these were sung in. It was in the later part of the 19th century that they had to really start bellowing out. And with all the limitations of this 63-year-old woman singing, the gramophone, no electronics, you know, this was all acoustic. Nevertheless, it's remarkable that we have these to listen to and have a little bit of history. I'd like to think that she sang Voi che sapete the evening that Anna heard her concert, but Tolstoy doesn't tell us what she sang, so we assume it had lots of love songs in it, and that there is a certain tension and irony going on. And you notice that she certainly does cause a bit of a stir, and one of the society ladies says, with a mixture of admiration and malice, she got more attention than Patti herself. Anyway, I thought you might get a kick out of a little bit of history that's in a fictional work.
Well, that was the enjoyment, now the suffering. My quiz is about the whole second half. Have we read the whole second half? You all finished? Is everybody finished?
No.
The whole second half.
There is a second half, yes.
Right, but I thought it used to.
Okay, so we haven't done that. How far did you read?
Thursday,
right. Yeah. You want to wait till Thursday? We won't have much to do.
Wait till Thursday. Yeah.
That's fine. My plan is to, however, is to discuss everything. I don't know if I can think of a quick alternative to discuss the whole rest of the novel.
Go ahead.
we might do a little review. We're going to be doing some reviewing, of course, this last week. So,
are we going to get our papers back on Thursday?
Or? No. But I will be reading them with increased. increasing interest as I go on. You know, so that's interesting. Just to go back to our upcoming movie, which may or may not be any good, you know, The Last Station. I was reading movie blurb websites that says, briefly, the summary of this is it's the story of socialist writer Leo Tolstoy. I wondered about that. Now, why would even popular culture consider him a, is it only socialists right? Is that it? But it's, is there a reason why he might be mistaken for a socialist writer?
Well, he had kind of a commune thing going on, his manner, so.
And here he is, and his hero, Levin, is a conservative, right? A conservative aristocrat. And it clearly could be said that this is showing the terrible consequences of adultery. And, there's definitely a religious epiphany at the end. So what makes Tolstoy so carry, nonetheless, a revolutionary profile? I think you've hit on something. The cult that sprung up around it, but why indeed did they?
Mm-hmm. I'm guessing that just the reviewer who said he was socialist, I'm confused with Dostoevsky, was a contemporary, honestly. Because those reviewers don't always do their research, they just watch the movie and help out the movie.
Quite true. But the cult may be the answer for that. And the whether one is socialist or not, the very desire to reform society, one is given the glorious title of socialist, I think.
Well, throughout the whole period of the Soviet Union, Tolstoy's reputation never flagged.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Dostoevsky had to be, he wasn't forgotten, but he had to be revived by people like Bakhtin.
That's right. Yes.
And Tolstoy is felt to be more, I suppose, appropriate.
Well, and it's remarkable that he was actually visited by Gandhi to pay homage to the great man, Tolstoy. So we have, in a sense, a kind of linkage of the 19th to the 20th century.
Did Gandhi speak Russian?
No, Tolstoy spoke English.
Oh. Yeah, there you go. The universal language. So with Anna's and Vronsky's return to Petersburg, we begin this the denouement, really, the final path downward for Anna and for Vronsky as well. And this is really a turning point, as Dr. Dupree was saying, for Vronsky to realize that Anna is headed on a fated course that no one really is going to be able to stop. Although this doesn't mean that he's going to be able to protect himself from it or to anticipate it when it comes. So the portrait of Anna in her decline is indeed is a magnificent portrait, but one that is tinged with the kind of tragedy that we see in Othello and others of the, you know, the great figure who has chosen something terrible and turns into, in part, a grotesque version of themselves, and at the same time, something about them seems, if anything, to burn with a more intense flame. Right? This seems to happen to Anna. There's a heartrending reuniting of her with her son, and we see how important that relationship is, how intensely the little boy cares for her. At the same time, we see that she is neglecting her young daughter. Why that is may not be immediately clear, but it's so important that Anna really ultimately doesn't want to divorce because she claims it would lower her in the eyes of her son, Seryozha. That's important. It's him that reflects her real self, whereas the newborn, the product of Vronsky, doesn't seem to have that call on her, that claim on her at all. So now, okay, we come to a new chapter when Dolly comes to visit Anna, and this is a chance to finally give a great deal of characterization to Dolly, who has remained a figure in the background up till now. And now it's suddenly discovered that she has thoughts, and indeed she has, she has thoughts and feelings that lead her at first to sympathize quite a great deal with Anna. This is part 6, and chapter 16. En route to visit her, we get a series of thoughts that Dolly has, right? All this, what's it for? What's to come of it all? And I'm wasting my life, never having a moment's peace, either with child or nursing a child. Forever irritable, peevish, wretched, myself, and worrying others, repulsive to my husband, while the children are growing up unhappy, badly educated, and penniless, and so forth. This is chapter 16, 550, thank you. I'm going to ask again for help with page numbers. So that I can't even bring the children up by myself and may find it hard with the help of other people at the cost of humiliation, why even if we suppose the greatest good luck that the children don't die and I bring them up somehow, at the very best they'll simply be decent people. That's all I can hope for. And to gain simply that. What agonies, what toil, one's whole life ruined, so forth. So a very passionate plea suddenly made here by Dolly. And again, speaking for woman in general, woman in the 19th century, the woman question is addressed here and with in terms that are still quite so current with the human condition. And she goes on to say, and they attack Anna. What for? Am I any better? I have, anyway, a husband I love, not as I should like to love him. Still, I do love him. While Anna never loved hers, how is she to blame? She wants to live. God has put that in our hearts. Very likely, I should have done the same. So, certainly one of the things that we keep coming back to and seeing different angles of in this novel is that question of the desire to live. It's stated in so many ways. What is it that makes that desire to live so important? And what importance do we give that to our lives? Is it, in fact, the cause of great creative innovations, or is it the cause of our downfall? Does it unknown suddenly turn into the desire to die, as we see as Anna goes on in her career? But the resonance of to live, it has such a 19th century ring to it that... I'm not sure if we can pick it up anymore in the jaded 21st century. Right? This was the century of the discovery of reality, right? The Russian intellectual Alexander Herzen went to study in Germany, and we have letters that he wrote back to friends in which he said, "I've just discovered the most magnificent concept here, reality. Reality, reality, it's all around us." And he goes on in this way, you know, so there's something about... This is the spirit in which novels are indeed come to reach their full development, right? This fascination with reality, the fascination with the innate sense of the desire to live, which we have to put on the other side of the roster from the desire for social respectability, right? Which is to be the same, which is, as the structuralists call it, social reproduction. Reproduce the structure over and over again, which sounds so dreary, but is absolutely, as this novel is dead set on showing us, absolutely essential. She wants to live. God has put that in her heart. Very likely I should have done the same. And then she says, I ought then to have cast off my husband and begun my life afresh. I might have loved and have been loved in reality. And is it any better as it is? I don't respect him. He's necessary to me. So the whole problem of all the suffering, all the self-negation, right, merely to have that position of the wife, position of the family, position of respectability, even a minimum respectability, right, with all the sufferings that go along with, you know, barely making it and so forth, is enunciated here by Dolly. And then it says she daydreamed a whole love affair, an almost identical love affair for herself with an imaginary composite figure, the ideal man who was in love with her. So charming Dolly doesn't even really make a wicked determination that she's going to go out and do something terrible, but her transgression is to imagine an affair with a composite man. when we see Anna in chapter 18, we see all these. She believes she's going to come in and sympathize with her and say the same thing, but she finds it strangely out of place now. Right? Anna says, she says to Dolly, Dolly says, I don't think anything, she said, but I always loved you. And if one loves anyone, one loves the whole person, just as they are, and not as one would like them to be. Anna, taking her eyes off her friend's face and dropping her eyelids, this was a new habit Dolly had not seen in her before, pondered, trying to penetrate the full significance of the words, and obviously interpreting them as she would have wished. She glanced at Dolly. If you had any sins, she said, they would all be forgiven you for your coming to see me and these words. And Dolly saw that the tears stood in her eyes. So we see our portrait of Anna, on the one hand, the magnanimity of her, the grandness of her heart. On the other hand, this new habit of half closing her eyelids, right, as if not to see what it is that, you know, she is having to face up with on a daily basis. We begin a whole motif of seeing how Anna has changed, subtle ways in which Anna changes in this last part of the novel. And so that is Anna's claim. I merely want to live. So very much an echo of what Dolly has said as well. But in chapter 19, we see another side of her, and that is that she has not really been paying attention to her daughter. Right? It says, from a few words that were dropped, Darya Alexandrovna saw at once that Anna, the two nurses, and the child had no common existence, and that the mother's visit was something exceptional. Anna wanted to get the baby her plaything and could not find it. Most amazing of all was the fact that on being asked how many teeth the baby had, Anna answered wrong and knew nothing about the two last teeth. So it's a pitiful detail, right? But we're also learning that Anna is focused only on what she's focused on at the time, right? And it's on her desire, on the object of her desire. She has committed herself to that, and she must carry it out. I don't know if you have another interpretation. If you do, I'd like to hear it. But I think that's what's unveiled about Anna in this meeting, this friendship between her and Dolly, is important. And what's unveiled about Dolly as well. Dolly goes on to plead Vronsky's wish that they would divorce, that she would divorce and they would marry. And Anna refuses, right? Says she will, first of all, she will have no more children. And we get a kind of serio-comic sequence in which she says, I will have no more children because I don't wish it. And Dolly is, what do you mean? Whatever do you mean by that? Because I don't wish it. And apparently we have dots on the page indicating that the conversation is not entirely told to us. And so Anna must have gone into some real details about how one can prevent having children. And Dolly is overwhelmed with this information. And it goes on to suggest that Dolly, this is chapter 23, she's amazed. So that's how all those people who only have two children did it. So it's a remarkable scene. But it, as comical as that is, or could be, Tolstoy keeps it in that, writes always in a strangely distanced way from his material. You know, we're not exactly sure how to take some of this.
Are we supposed to assume that Anna is probably talking about downing contraceptive or abortifacient herbs because she does not wish children? Or just she thinks it's magically going to prevent her from being fertile?
I'm perfectly happy for the dots on the page to be there, but I think it could be something a good deal simpler than that. let's just leave it at that. the comical side of this is whisked away when she states the amazing, the breathtaking lines, "What is reason given me for if I am not to use it to avoid bringing unhappy beings into this world?"
And
that's Anna at the very end of that little conversation. And I don't know if we have a, can anybody find that this one line of hers in chapter 23 as
page 579.
Wasn't there also like a suggestion that she had childbed fever and most women were, could never have children after that anyway?
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so it's not necessarily...
Well, but the way it's portrayed in this chapter, it sounds like she has knowledge that Dolly didn't have, and Dolly is so astounded, and Dolly's like, "Why didn't I ever think of this?" or something. But it is true. It is true. I think I had that sense too that she, after the illness that she had, she's not going to be able to have children anyway. But she does say, "Because I don't wish it," right? So, and then I think that astounding line: "What is reason given us for, if not to keep us, not to allow us to keep from bringing unhappy beings into this world?" Right. So,
bottom of 578.
Thank you. Bottom of 578. So, yeah. Joe, did you have a comment?
I was just going to, wasn't it because of the illness she had the first time, like every time she had a child after that, she would just be like really sick throughout it? Like,
that could be.
I don't remember where it is. But she said something about like, "I could have children and be terribly sick, or not have them at all."
I see. Okay. Well, that would add to it, wouldn't it?
So rather than like she can't have children because of the fever.
Good sleuthing, Joe. Thank you. I appreciate that. Reason is a theme, of course, that runs through this novel and as well. And what is reason given us for is a good question that Tolstoy probes as we go on through the novel, again, from several angles, right? Is it, in fact... given to us so that we can pursue our self-interest? Right? Is reason simply a tool of the overwhelming 19th century utilitarian rule that we know already so well from Dostoevsky's attack at it, of utilitarianism, of self-interest? Here it seems more tortured than that. It seems something almost Manichaean, right? That there is a, you know, the Manichaeans said sex was fine as long as you didn't bring any children into this world. And so this is very similar to that idea. Anna is finding herself cut off from the sources of life in this world without wanting it, but forced in that way by the position she has put herself in.
I forget why the Manichaeans said having kids was bad.
Me too. I just remember
flesh,
that.
Because the flesh is evil.
Yeah. That's right.
And the body is the result of the principle of evil.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah, Brunsky.
That's what Augustine renounced, you might remember. Okay.
Brunsky, on the other hand, wants a divorce because without a divorce legally, any children that Anna has then are Karenin's children. And so she doesn't want to bring any more children in the world who are part of the these ambiguous situations.
Mm.
She says she doesn't mind suffering in childbirth.
Exactly.
But, and it's interesting that she wants to spare them what she had discovered, what social rejection leads to, the kind of anguish and suffering that it represents.
Exactly. So, caught in from several vantage points, she is caught in. In the next chapter, in 24, we discover that divorce, she realizes, will make Seryozha despise her, and so she will never do it. Right? She says, "It is only these two creatures that I love, two creatures, Seryozha and Alexei," by which she means Vronsky. So she's caught in an in-between world where she can't marry Vronsky because that would lower her in Seryozha's estimate. So at the end of this very intense visit, Dolly returns thinking, you know, just how sweet and precious her own world is that she has despised coming out in the visit. So it's a terrible visit, but it leaves Dolly thinking, recalibrating her own life, and having really understood, maybe not in a beautiful way, but that her life is something to be thankful for, after all. Now, so that's part of our story of decline. The rest of that comes with the later part of chapter 7, of part 7. And see if I could avoid talking about it. Now, at any rate, Karenin, we will avoid talking about it for a little bit. We want to talk about Karenin and Countess Lydia Ivanovna, right, as she worms her way into his affections. And back in part 5, getting him to do more than he would naturally do to separate himself from Anna. If we've had any affection for Karenin, and I tried hard to build a case for him last time, we tend to lose a lot of it in this exposition of his feelings. At the same time, Tolstoy does whatever he can to make us understand him, or to make us try to understand him, make us want to understand him. And we see that, as he says, in his growing up as he did not grow up as a man of feeling, right? That this was not something that was ever in his range. But now, because he never made friends outside of work, so forth, now he finds himself truly alone. Right? So, in a sense, although we find him on the one hand an unsympathetic character, that's all the more reason to have sympathy for him now. He senses himself a laughingstock. But what do we make of Countess Lydia? What is Tolstoy doing with Countess Lydia? What do you think? Therese, any comment on her?
Actually wondering, like, if that's something.
Good comment. I think that by he really puts religion in play as another theme or motif in the novel by having someone who has this hypocrisy and considers herself to be so deeply biased. So,
is the Countess Lydia's religion altogether orthodox?
No, he says it's some new flavor that had swept through Petersburg at that time. It sounds almost kind of like Protestant-ish. I don't know. That might be a little too extreme for Russia. But.
What are the characteristics of it that we get here in the novel?
A lot of unconditional love for one's neighbor, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but it's all based on, it's very emotionally driven, mm-hmm. charged, I guess.
So it would be a pietism mm-hmm. of a sort. What do we know about this?
There's a tinge of something else. That is, there's a seance.
Yes.
Isn't there? Mm-hmm. Now, she would have been younger, but this is the period of when Madame Blavatsky, 1870s, let's see, she's a young woman then, but Madame Blavatsky, you know who influenced Yeats, and Madame Blavatsky was Russian, and she was the founder of a whole spiritualist movement that included the occult and all of these things. So on the one side, the interesting thing about the late 19th century and the early 20th century is that on the one side you had utilitarianism, mm. one extreme, on the other, then you had this business of speaking with the dead in seances. And
the American version was spirit rapping, spirit mm-hmm. rappers, right?
Yeah,
which we read about
rapping,
in the Blithedale Romance of Hawthorne. Is mentioned, but yeah, this is true. So, in other words, spirit and flesh are, in a sense, going farther and farther apart in the different ideologies that come to bear. The more materialist an ideology you have, the more outrageous a spiritualist one you've got to counter it with. And Tolstoy is quite critical of that. He talks about Karenin's delusion of salvation, right, when he does as Countess Lydia wishes, and she obviously is using him to have another object to fall in love with. She's a serial infatuator, or infatuatee, I guess I should say, and writes a really cruel letter to Anna. This exchange of letters is quite arresting between the two of them. But allows us to see the hypocrisy of Lydia. Anna's letter is actually, let's take a look at this. It's near the end of chapter 23, part 5, chapter 23. Madame la Comtesse, the Christian feelings with which your heart is filled give me the, I feel, unpardonable boldness to write to you. I am miserable at being separated from my son. He goes on, appealing then to her, Christian feelings, showing that Anna can conceive of them perhaps only as feelings of sympathy and mercy, which are indeed good things, but they're also the things that Lydia has no regard for. And writes a letter that I think is cruel because it's true, as she writes it back to her and says, "Dear Madame," and this is chapter 25, "to be reminded of you might have results for your son in leading to questions on his part which could not be answered without implanting in the child's soul a spirit of censure towards what should be for him sacred. I don't know how you, do you have it translated in a similar way? In
Yeah.
All in, it's an incredible work of grammar, a sentence, right? And therefore, I beg you to interpret your husband's refusal in the spirit of Christian love. So in other words, it's in your own best interest to condemn yourself, would be one way to paraphrase that. And another is, if you continue to love your son, then you will make sure you never see him, because that would sully him. So now, meanwhile, though we have to say then that of the men in our story, now again, Karenin, I'm sorry, Tolstoy is looking at the modern society, at Russian society as it's becoming modern. We see certainly a split between Karenin and Vronsky as the man of duty, right, versus the man of passion, and never the twain shall meet. Right. As somebody who's been studying the Aeneid recently, that has a resonance to me, because the problem of the first half of the Aeneid is to get Aeneas to be both. Right. And there are times in which he is one, and there are times in which he is another. Right. And so we're looking for the hero, we're looking for the positive hero of Russia, but they are indeed far apart. And Karenin, for whatever may be said of him, is the man of duty, the man who embraces duty, but with that fatal flaw of not having the amour that should go along with that. He is himself not sufficiently lovable, if you will. Although Dolly's marriage, again, makes us have to think twice before we can justify Anna for what she has done. Vronsky, man of passion only, lacks a sense of duty altogether, and how ironic, because he is a man of the army, and ends up resigning from the army, at least until the very end. So that split is very important, right? In terms of if we are to talk about a hero as a man of action, both in a sense are men of action in different ways. Karenin by going upward in society, right, becoming more substantial and powerful, and so forth. Vronsky, as the same person who is most seemingly the man of action, but when anytime he takes a definite action, it seems to destroy itself or to destroy others around him in some way. Right. These are also men who suffer. And as the novel goes on, it stresses more and more how little these men have left in them to be able to act, and how much what they have to do is simply to suffer. Right. So it's an action turned to suffering is what we see in these two as they're split. Well, if we don't have the man of action, what do we have? Well, we have a character that we recognize in a number of other great novels, and that is man as experiencer, right? As beholder, as witness, right? And this is, of course, Levin, right? Levin. Not the man of action, but the one who takes in these things in his heart and studies them. And unlike Ishmael in Moby Dick, who has to see a great white whale before he starts thinking anything profound, unlike Isaac in Go Down Moses, who has to see a big old bear, Levin does this by means of seeing things like death and birth. It's very, very simple. This is Tolstoy's contribution to the novel hero of receptivity, of experience, of contemplation, of the power of consciousness in the novel to give value to a world that is left without any symbolic support without any, you know, creative support, without any addressing of values and of good and evil in life. So Levin, first we see him struck and really outmanned by the unmanned, I should say, by the death of his brother, in which he finds himself unable to act. And he finds himself, through his brother, having to face this existential crisis with death itself. Meanwhile, his brother is busy dying, right? So I'm sorry you're having that existential crisis. I happen to be dying here. But it's Kitty who understands that immediately, without criticism, without dialogue. He just gets in there and does what is natural. It allows Tolstoy, of course, to make another remark about, you know, what women have instinctive in their makeup that men are lacking entirely in. Yeah.
Do you mean Jovan's brother?
Yeah.
Did I?
You said Vronsky's brother.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah. Nikolai. Yeah. Or is that how he comes out?
There's that moment when the priest leans over Nikolai and says, it's over. And Nikolai says, not yet, but soon. And you see in that this kind of preparation for death, that the priest, for whom death is a kind of routine thing that he ministers to, but he doesn't quite see the exact sign. He doesn't interpret the signs quite correctly.
Tolstoy, of course, was obsessed with death and with dying and with facing the existential crisis of death and so forth. And it's not to be made light of. He also criticizes those who make light of it. But so we see certainly this as a concern of Tolstoy's himself. But he's also showing Levin as being unable, you know, just to be concerned with it like that makes you unable to do anything. Right? You cannot do what has to be done. But also that the very process of Nikolai's death in chapter 20, as he approaches death, we see that he actually comes to desire it, right? This is after, you know, Kitty has made the place smell nice again and have clean linen and so forth. And we actually see after that moment where he says to the priest, you know, not yet, a minute later the face brightened. A smile came out under the mustaches, and the women who had gathered round began carefully laying out the corpse. So, death, it's a good death, in other words, right? To die with a smile. Tolstoy is so concerned about that. And he wants, it, of course, suits Tolstoy also not to have the priest not get it right. We read that ending of chapter 20, last two paragraphs, right? The sight of his brother and the nearness of death revived in Levin that sense of horror in face of the insoluble enigma, together with the nearness and inevitability of death that had come upon him that autumn evening when his brother had come to him. Now we remember when that happened earlier in the novel. But by the end of that paragraph and by the end of this chapter, we see another mystery now that Levin has to face, and that's the mystery of life. Kitty is with child, so all of this happens so quickly. Again, the most basic human experiences are things that leave Levin agog. Right? So now he himself then visits Anna. Right after, well, not, somewhat after Dolly has visited Anna, and we some of our most impressive, some of our most vivid impressions of Anna at this stage come from Levin. In book 7, chapter 9, coordinate my pages at all, I'm sorry. But he comes to visit Anna, and he's struck by the portrait of her that he sees, right? The portrait by Mikhailov. And he's dazzled by it. It's so beautiful. and presents such a magnificent person. And then she herself appears to him and says, right, he's dazzled yet again. Right, here is someone that's more beautiful than ever. This is part 7,
mm-hmm.
part 7, chapter 9. And we'll find out a little detail that as Anna perceives him, she opens a cigarette case, takes out a cigarette. She started to smoke. Again, one of those details that shows how things have changed for her, how she herself has changed. And he is nonetheless so impressed by her. He says, besides wit, grace, and beauty, she had truth, but her face somehow seemed turned to stone. So he feels tenderness and pity for her. And naively enough, doesn't see any guilt in that, and so goes back to his wife and tells her that he has visited Anna. Kitty is not happy that this has happened. She cries and she accuses him, and he has to reassure her, and she makes him a promise to avoid her in the future. And lest we think then that Kitty has gone overboard, in the very next chapter, Tolstoy tells us that Anna had, in fact, tried to arouse love in Levin, the way that she behaves quite subtly toward him. That this is, again, a new aspect of her character. Again, a woman who in small ways, small but telling ways, Tolstoy portrays as becoming desperate. She now also reveals that she feels neglected by Vronsky. And in this chapter, chapter 12, it says that when he comes home late after gambling, she feels an evil spirit of strife that has grown up between them. So these are important developments as the last stage is being prepared for. Well, the birth of Kitty's and Levin's child, again, we're into a zone that you all have got to read for yourselves if you haven't read it yet. But it's look at it, if you will, going into it as with the parallel of what we saw and with the way that Levin faces the death of his brother. It's terror followed by serenity, perhaps, with his brother, but it's terror followed by overwhelming joy with the birth of Kitty's child. And the last parts of the novel are given to a magnificent tragic fall of Anna that happens even as it's happening. You say it's happening quicker than you'd like. You know, you'd like for it to go on, even though it's misery. And then afterward, a long series of chapters giving us nothing but the interior thoughts of Levin, right, about the meaning of life. So we get a long ending to the novel that goes over really every aspect of Levin's experience, every aspect of his notion of existence itself. So that Tolstoy has thrown himself into this a great deal. And I think that we find there's a very significant moment that I will just tell you this much about it, that that he feels that he's exchanged his garment of knowledge of the meaning of life for a knowledge of a life that is without meaning, right? And that he himself can't believe in any of the fairy tale things that religion and tradition tell him, that he believes only the things that science tells him, and yet he senses how poor that is. So he feels naked. He doesn't. He has exchanged his garment and has no other garment to wear towards the vicissitudes of life. So, in this, Tolstoy is certainly sketching again the modern world. He's sketching the modern person. He is certainly sketching himself to a great degree, but also perhaps mankind looked at historically, that this is an event that has happened historically, that this the garment of belief has been shed in a Matthew Arnold-like way, and we can see how Matthew Arnold looked like Tolstoy. One is left with trying to figure out what to make of no longer having that garment. And those are the last considerations of this powerful novel. So, questions and comments on these characters so far? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just questions and comments in general. Do you have a study guide for the final for us today?
I do, and I'll get it to you next time.
Okay.
I mean, it'll be a very general study guide, but what we want to be thinking about are, of course, the major novels that we've read, that is to say, everything that we've read. Nothing but major novels in this class. There will be a section on identification, but these will not be as small and picky questions as the ones that we've been throwing at you. You will want to remember names of major characters and what they do in a more, you know, slightly more distant way, but the major parts of the exam will be an essay, and in that. Hmm?
Will there be a choice of essays, or just one that you'll spring on us?
Well, one way that I've done with considerable success, I think, has been to give classes three possible topics, and then choose in the secrecy of my heart which one you will actually write on the exam day.
Okay.
So we might have something like that. But who knows? It might have been easier if you hadn't asked. But it's better to know. Better to know these things. Yes.
Will we have to pick up our essays next semester?
Oh no! I'll get to them before you. I'm working on them even now. Okay. My goal is to have them back to you on exam day.
What's the average
Average success rate. Nobody has been banished into outer darkness yet. Now,
you might bear in mind, just to sort of round things out, if you look at the trajectory from Pushkin, whom we didn't really read, but I nevertheless did post a copy of The Bronze Horse, but on Blackboard, hoping that you might. But already there, you see, we had this kind of ambivalence between the poor crazed man on the one hand and the emblem of power and change in the Bronze Horseman. But the horse that chases the man in his delirium through St. Petersburg after the flood, we find that transformed into the wheel at the beginning of Dead Souls. How far do you think that wheel could go, you know? Mm-hmm. Could it go to as far as Moscow? No, but it could go as far as, you see. Mm-hmm. How far will this go? What, the wheel, first the horse, the bronze horse, then the wheel, then the railway. And of course, at the end, we see the railway in part is tied up with a whole change in politics as well. And Lovin is totally lost in this new world of politics. And that scene in which he, at the insistence of his other brother, his half-brother, he goes and they say, oh no, you know, we've got to all vote for the marshal. And they say, well, why? Well, no, wait. No, I thought you didn't want the marshal there. Oh, what has he done wrong? Well, no, actually, he hasn't done anything wrong. He hasn't done anything crooked, but he's the old order. He's an aristocrat, and he has to be replaced by the new order. And so these hooves at the beginning that turn into carriage wheels and Dead Souls, and then finally into the rails and the railway, the train wheels that crush Anna at the end, gives this sense of a kind of dreadful balance in the Russian psyche, the fear that if it's pushed too far, it will become itself a wreck on the kind of frantic progress that has come from the West. And you get these moments of hesitation in very interesting places. What do you make, for example, of Vronsky's sudden managerial skills on the estate? He takes the estate and he's going to fix it up. And Dolly says, "Oh, are you going to have a lying-in section in this hospital, this magnificent building?" And Vronsky is just lightly irritated. He says, "No, this is for sick people." You know, so this is Vronsky trying to move in the realm of the reformer. And you see him contrasted with Rovin, who is a very different kind of reformer, who tries various schemes of reform, and none of them is satisfactory as we go through. But it seems to be on 538, we have a kind of moment where we get the point of view of the dog here. This is sort of like the point of view of the horse.
Yeah.
This is in the other one. So they're out hunting. Tolstoy himself liked to hunt. And in fact, this is what he would go do when he got stuck with Anna Karenina. He couldn't figure out what to do next, and he started hating the novel he was working on, so he'd go out hunting.
Yeah, it says, by the way, that in the diaries of his wife tell us that she would go out hunting with him.
Yeah. It's a good way to kind of, it is another form of defamiliarization, if you think about it. You know, instead of being the hunted, you're the hunter. Anyway, here and there among the mosses and docks, the smell was very strong. It was impossible to decide in which direction it grew stronger or weaker. And so, hardly aware of her legs under her, we had to go further away in the direction of the wind. Now, we get Laska's point of view, the dogs. Laska ran at a strained gallop, which she could cut short at a bound should occasion arise, to the right, away from the morning breeze which blew from the east, and then turned to windward. After inhaling the air with distended nostrils, she knew at once that not their set only, but they themselves were there before her. Not one only, but many of them. She slackened speed. They were there, but she could not yet determine exactly where. To decide this, she began working round in a circle. See, so this is the wheel again. When her master's voice disturbed her, "Laska, here," he said, pointing to the other side. She stood still, as if asking him whether it would not be better to continue as she had begun. See, the dog saying, "Are you sure? Are you open?" But he repeated his command in a stern voice, pointing to a group of hummocks covered with water where there could not be anything. She obeyed, pretending to search in order to please him. Went over the whole place, and then returned to the first spot and immediately scented them once more. Now that he was not hindering her, she knew what to do, and without looking where she was stepping, stumbling over hummocks and getting into the water, but surmounting the obstacles with her flexible, strong legs, she began the circle, which was to make everything clear. Their scent came to her once more, and more pungently, and more distinctly, and all at once, it became quite clear to her that one of them was here behind a hummock 5 steps in front. And so she, you know, finally she catches them, and she seems to, so it seemed to her, we're told, he, with his terrible face, but ever terrible eyes, came stumbling over the hummocks, but unusually slowly, she thought. So it seemed to her, though in actuality, he was running. Now, what this scene does is to play, in one moment, the whole cycle of Jovin's career, if you think about it. So it's the balance, on the one hand, of the guidance of the hunter with the dog. The dog works by instinct and by scent, but can't see. And once the scent is lost, then the dog is lost. But Jovin, who's standing up here, can see things that the dog can't see. So it's this working together. And for Jovin, that ultimately is the land. The land is like the dog, and he's got to figure out how to work with the land. On one hand, how to direct it. On the other hand, how to use it and how to respect it. So you notice that Yovan goes through all these different kinds of schemes, trying to figure out which one will work. In the end, he ends up doing exactly what Laska has done here. Ah, now I see it. Okay, here it all is. So it's rather interesting, these little details that Tolstoy gives us that in little give us a kind of trajectory of a whole character's future, you might say, because this is before the actual political debate and all of that, from which he learns nothing. But in the hunt, he does learn something. And he learns something about how to live life in relation to what is reality here. And he's killing little birds, you know, or big birds, maybe. But still, it's part of the interaction of a man with the environment that surrounds him. Anyhow, it's
nice.
A fascinating
nice.
A set of things, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. So the naturalness is always one of Tolstoy's great recommendations for how to get out of the jam that we're in.
By the way, Tolstoy's nickname was Yovin, and that's why L-E-V-I-N is pronounced Yovin. Lev is Lev, but when it becomes a diminutive, little Lev, Yovina, then the E changes to a Yo in Russian. And so that's why it's there is some significance in that vowel that's spelled one way but pronounced another.
Well, thank you. Finish reading Anna Karenina. We'll talk about the whole course next time.
The rest of the week.